likely we get a 10x in Bitcoin over the next 7-8 years. That's nothing like they have experienced up to now. If Powell comes out this week and he's tremendously hawkish and he does not keep the door open for a rate cut, the OGs, the whales that have been around for a long time, I think some of them want to remain in Bitcoin, but they want to get a little bit more out of it. The way to do that is the ultimate end game is to, you're going to see a drawdown in the market. That's my opinion. I believe it's pretty obvious, though. Protect your treasury, not by buying bonds, but by buying Bitcoin, because bonds will be melted away with extreme inflation. There's a long, long runway here for Bitcoin and a multiple that return, I believe.
What's up, guys? Before we get started, I've realized that over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back for every single episode. And while I'm eternally grateful for you guys to keep coming back, I've realized that 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I have one small ask before we get started. If you guys could hit that subscribe button and hit that like button to help send this interview and many more to the stratosphere, it would be greatly appreciated. All right, enough for me. Let's get into the show. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, recurring guest, James Lavish in the house. And I think this is the perfect time to get James on the show, because with your Wall Street experience and, you know, the fund, all of the businesses that are going on, it seems like the Bitcoin treasury companies are the new wave. But we have a little bit of a wrinkle here right now where Bitcoin just smashed a new all-time high and then creep back a little bit, but these treasury companies are not performing as well as one might have thought in the past. So, James, what is going on with these treasury companies? Is it all over?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here, Brandon. Always good to talk to you. And even though you're an Aggie, it's we're going to put that in the back seat for a little bit. But I may troll you.
already starting with it.
there's a lot of stuff that's going on, and really a lot of stuff that's not going on. And through my career, I've spent 30 years watching this on Wall Street. Every single summer we get to the same spot where it's just, you call it the summer doldrums, whatever. People are off, they're on vacation, they're in Europe, they're in the Hamptons, they're down on the Cape, they're just not paying attention, and they're kind of unplugged at the end of the summer here. I mean, we're in the depth of August. I'm in Vegas and it's so abusively hot outside that you're basically, if you're still in Vegas, then you're working on stuff, but everybody else is, they're in California, they're in Colorado, they're in Utah, they're just not around. So, I mean, my neighborhood is a ghost town right now. So that's kind of, that's a big part of it. So a big part of what you're seeing is these big moves that are on light volume. And so what we see is somebody who goes and wants to build up a big position, they're going to have to move the stock or the Bitcoin price or the treasury price, because there's not a lot of volume out there. So this weekend and into today, we're seeing these large enough moves, multi-percent moves in Bitcoin. Sounds like a lot, $3,000, but it's really only 2.5%, not that big of a deal for Bitcoin. But there's not a lot of volume, Brandon. It's like it's more of a buyer strike than a tsunami of sellers, So that's one thing. This is a big week. Politically, you've got Trump just had basically every European official leader in his office in a semicircle around his office, called into the principal's office to negotiate a peace deal for for Ukraine. And he doesn't want a ceasefire. He wants a peace deal. And so, that's an overarching kind of thing that's going on politically right now. While you've got financially, there's so much uncertainty in the markets financially. I wrote about this past weekend in my newsletter that you know, this is a big week for the Fed. Why is it a big week for the Fed? Because this is Jackson Hole week. This is the week where they have the economic symposium. And this has grown from this small little invite-only little gathering for, as kind of like a place for Fed officials and central bankers and some of the bankers and leaders to get together and talk about where the economy is and what they think the policy ought to be going forward, and kind of maybe float some ideas, bat them around. Now it's an absolute circus. It's a zoo. You've got everybody coming in from around the world that descend into this little, you know, city in Wyoming. And it's become like the ultimate boondoggle for a lot of them. But for one person in particular, it becomes their legacy, you know, or their chance to cement their legacy. And that's Chairman Powell. And so this is the last time he gets to speak at this conference. And what it is they're out there in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It's kind of sleepy. It's Western. You got barbecue. You got fly fishing, you know. And it used to be that the reporters would go there and they would try to get some more down-to-earth commentary from these officials. And like maybe catch them off guard, maybe, or less guarded, maybe, right? So it's not like they're trying to trick them. They're just, they're less guarded in what they say, whatever. But it's not like that anymore. You know, he's not on a podium. He's not at an official press conference, but he does have an official press appointment on Friday morning where he talks to them about what occurred throughout the week. And believe me when I say that every single investor who's in the office and not on the Cape and not in the Hamptons and not in Nantucket, and they're not in, you know, Colorado and California, they're actually paying attention and they're hanging on every single syllable that he utters. And the reason for that is that we've had a lot of conflicting economic data over the last number of weeks. We had massive job revisions from the BLS, which ultimately resulted in Trump getting pissed off and firing the head of BLS. We had a kind of a benign CPI number. We had a massive surprise in the PPI, which people are attributing to tariffs. And then we had some really strong retail sales numbers. And so what unemployment's, you know, the employment's getting softer, unemployment's rising, yet prices are still coming. They're staying in a range that the Fed is getting more comfortable with, around that 3% range. And now you've got this PPI number, which is the producer price index, which means that prices of goods for wholesalers have gone up. And that means that eventually what you would expect is that rise in prices will be passed on to the consumers. It'll come in the CPI eventually. And then you've got the retail sales numbers, which is like, is this because you have these very strong demographic, a wealthy demographic, an older demographic, whether it's the top 1% or it's just the boomers that are still spending? Or is it also, you know, YOLO? Charge it up, put it on credit cards, and you're seeing credit card rates and delinquencies rise. Not the interest rates, but the amount of usage. And so what is it? Is it people are just like, well, screw it. I'm never going to be able to buy a house. I'm Gen Z. I'm not going to be able to put enough money away. So I might as well just spend it on this trip or this vacation or go to Vegas or whatever. Which actually we're not seeing them come to Vegas. That's a whole nother category. The casinos here have completely annihilated themselves with their excessive charges on everything. They upcharge on everything, even like $25 bottles of water in your hotel room, like absolutely insane. So that's the question. People are like, all right, where are we economically? And by and large, what people, investors, are coming to the conclusion of is that the Fed's going to capitulate. They're going to lower rates here in September, in just a few weeks. In just about 3 weeks, they're going to lower rates and by 25 basis points. If you look at Fed funds futures, it shows about an 85% probability of that happening. That's what investors believe. At least that's how they're hedged. And so now you've got Powell, and what does he say? What does he say this week on Friday? Is he hawkish? Does he continue to hammer on the point that we're data dependent? Does he concede that we're making strong headway in inflation, and we're not as worried about that? We're now turning our attention over to the unemployment situation. Because if he does say that, then that means that they're not going to worry about the inflation. Like, that's kind of in check, but we're more worried about this, which means that we need to get closer to the neutral rate, which would not be expansionary and it wouldn't be contractionary. Like, it would be kind of the neutral rate, which we're clearly well above that right now. And so the question is, what words does he use, and maybe what words doesn't he use, in order to describe what he believes, where he believes we are? Now, Brandon, I think he comes at this in a way that solidifies his legacy. This is the last chance he gets to give his, kind of off the cuff, a little bit less formal, informal setting of, hey, how did I do over my tenure as chairman of the Fed? Because this is his last shot at that. And so this is where he gets to just talk about what he wants to talk about and frame his legacy the way he wants to frame it. And I believe that regardless of all the noise that you've had.
What if I told you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven.
With Trump, ushering him into that building and embarrassing him with the way he's got that hard hat on. He just looks like a little boy over there next to him, and pulling out the paper and, as if he's like the principal admonishing his student, I think regardless of all that noise, I think that Powell wants to solidify his legacy that he got the job done. He did not let inflation rage out of control, although it did rage and it nearly got out of control. And it was because of what the Fed did. Let's make that clear. They caused this problem. But he did put the fire out, and he wants to cement his legacy there. Now, the question is, what words does he use to do that? And I believe that he's going to come out and he's going to say that we're getting comfortable with the trajectory of inflation. We're more concerned about jobs, which means that it opens the door for a 25 basis point cut in September, which is a really big deal for stocks and risk assets and things like Bitcoin and gold, because it's an expansion of liquidity. Basically, you make the cost of capital lower, which is good for those kinds of assets and securities. And so, but I do believe he leaves the door open. And what you're seeing right now is some uncertainty around how he's going to come out this week. What kind of numbers are still coming? Because we still have another CPI, another PPI, another PCE. We got more unemployment numbers between now and the next September meeting. And he could change his mind like that. And so there's probably some uncertainty going on, and Bitcoin's definitely sniffing that out and getting a little nervous here. Again, on very light volume. That's a long answer to your question, but that's where I believe we're at right now in the general market.
Yeah, and that those are all great points. And I want to dive into a little bit more about Jerome Powell and the Fed, right? Because, I mean, Trump has basically been, yeah, like you said, almost like bullying him to try to get him to lower interest rates for a while. And Powell's been, I guess, to a certain extent, holding steady just because his belief has been like inflation is not under wraps. And, you know, depending on what data you look at, you can find essentially whatever you want to see in this data, right? I mean, you named a few of these numbers. We've seen a massive revisions in the jobs market. But on the flip side of things, like the S&P 500, Bitcoin, like everything in the market is seeming to do all right, hitting new all-time highs and kind of having this pump here. But then, you know, the consumer looks to be struggling. And then CPI, you know, seems to be doing okay at that 2.7. We're staying underneath that 3 range. So how would you categorize it? Do you think that we're kind of in this space where we essentially, you know, we're okay? We have inflation somewhat under control. It's not going and spiraling out of control. Mm-hmm. And we need to lower interest rates in order to, I guess, make the economy a little bit more healthy so this data isn't just so conflicting. Or is there something deeper underneath the hood here where, you know, maybe cutting interest rates might be a bad thing?
Yeah, I think personally, from what I'm seeing, I think that the economy is rolling over, that the jobs numbers were terribly inflated by fiscal spending, by the Biden administration hiring, you know, millions of people. And so I think that has kind of covered up this, what could have been a recession last year and the rollover of the economy here. And so, the people losing their jobs, that it happens so rapidly, Brandon, that's why you have something called the SOM rule. And the SOM rule says that if you get over, if the unemployment rate rises more than 0.5% from its lows, and there's more math to it, but that's just oversimplifying it. But for all intents and purposes, that means that the SOM rule is tripped. That means you're already in a recession, and it jumps from there. It doesn't just go to 4.3%. It goes 5, 6, 7, 8%. Like it happens so quickly, and you see it in all the recessions. You can just go chart out unemployment against recessions, you could see how quickly it happens. And so I do believe we're rolling over. I do believe that interest rates are too tight and we do need to lower them soon. What we're seeing in pricing is it's difficult to figure out for a number of reasons. You've had a lot of chatter about it and a lot of noise from mainstream media, specifically around tariffs and how tariffs are going to be inflationary. And I think that scared people into buying the things that they needed to buy, wanted to buy in the first quarter, in the first half of this year. Big things, iPhones, you know, there was talk about how iPhones could double or triple in price if Trump insisted on bringing all that manufacturing back to the United States and levying massive tariffs on Apple. We saw that was avoided, that, you know, Tim Cook went into the White House and conceded that they would be specifically building parts of iPhones here and bringing that back on shore. But people bought iPhones, they went out and bought washers and dryers, they bought cars because they're worried about these tariffs that are being levied on them. And so, some of this could be a one-time pass-through. Also, producers went out and bought a bunch of goods to make sure that they were able to get the hard materials, the raw materials to make whatever they need to make for the consumers. And so there was, the demand spiked a little bit in the first half of the year. How much of that has impacted pricing? It's hard to say. The second thing is, even if it does impact pricing, even if tariffs do impact pricing negatively and prices rise, I believe that would be a short-term, one-time deal. And it's not like you would have ongoing, you know, 3.5% inflation and a spike of inflation ongoing because of tariffs. It would be a one-time 3.5% back down to wherever it was headed after that. It's just a blip according to the tariffs. it'll be difficult to see that because these tariffs are being kind of doled out along the way. So it won't happen in just one quarter or one print, but it'll happen over a series of them. And then that's it. So it still has to do with the economy ultimately and how well the economy is doing and how much money supply is out there and chasing after these goods. And so I don't believe that structurally tariffs will long-term raise and keep raising inflation. It doesn't make sense to me mathematically. So, but I do believe that we need to start lowering rates. And the reason for that is the Fed keeps saying they're data dependent. They say it over and over and over and over and over. They hide behind this. We're data dependent. We're data dependent. We're data dependent. And then you see certain data and you're like, well, you don't seem to be depending on this data. Number one, you're picking and choosing. Evidence of that is right before the election, the Fed lowered rates by 50 basis points. There in that September before the election, there was really, it wasn't warranted to lower them 50 basis points. They might have been, unless you expected them to keep lowering. If they're going to lower by 50 basis points, the expectation is 25 the next one, 25 the next one, 20, then maybe pause. You don't just lower 50% of 50 basis points and pause. That was very odd. It's pretty uncharacteristic for the history of the Fed to do something like that. And it was pretty political, obviously. Whether they were getting tremendous pressure from Elizabeth Warren, who had a big voice before the election, it's kind of quieted down quite a bit because people are seeing through her nonsense, but and how much it cost, how many votes it cost the Democrats for her to be anti-crypto. But you know, it was clearly political, and for the Fed to claim they're not political, they can't bend to the pressure of Trump now. So that's clear too. So, however, the situation we're in, I think that the data is giving Powell enough air cover, especially on the employment side, that he could ease by 25 basis points. And it's not that he's giving in to Trump. If he was giving it to Trump, he'd ease 50. You know, because that's what Bessent just demanded. For all intents and purposes, again, he didn't tell him to do that. He said that the models are showing that we're 150 basis points, like 1.5% above neutral, which I think is aggressive. I think we're maybe 1% above neutral. But regardless, whatever models you're using, we are above and we could ease. But and I think that it's time. And so the markets are starting to tell you that. And you know, the stock market will suffer. If Powell comes out this week and he's tremendously hawkish, if he's terribly hawkish and he does not keep the door open for a rate cut, you're going to see a drawdown in the market. That's my opinion. I believe it's pretty obvious, though. But I think Bitcoin and some of the tech stocks are getting nervous here. You had not great earnings this morning from some of the tech leaders, and you know, and so the Qs are off, and the S&P is kind of dragging a little bit, and Bitcoin is leading the way. It continues to be the tip of the risk spear. I don't believe it should be, but it is, and you know, we just have to recognize that. People have to get their heads around that, especially the maxis, who I agree with them that it shouldn't be, but it is right now because it's considered that way. And it's going to continue to trade that way until further notice, you know? And so that's kind of where we're at.
So it seems like everybody's just seemingly waiting for, I guess, maybe this Jackson Hole prior to the rate cut in September, if that even occurs. I mean, who knows at this point? But
and the other data that's coming out along the way, right?
Yeah, and I want to dive into that because you said that, you know, the Fed has always come out and said that they're very data dependent. But the revisions and, you know, if you look at the way CPI has been calculated, like one of my favorite websites is govflation.com. It shows how CPI used to be calculated back in like 1982, I think, which was like the first revision post gold standard. And, you know, the gap in between that just keeps, you know, rising and rising. And, you know, it seems like CPI, they're always excluding food and energy, and same with PPI. So, you know, when a Fed is data dependent, and it seems like a lot of this data is either collected by surveys or leaving, you know, certain things out, changing the baskets of goods for CPI. Yeah, how reliable do you feel that this data is? And do you think that that's, you know, the right approach?
I think it's terribly unreliable, as we've seen, and it's lagging. And so the problem here is that you've got data that's lagging, and then you've got a Fed that lags the data. So they miss the mark every time. They overshoot. But you've also heard Powell say that he'd rather overshoot on tightening than on loosening, because it's kind of like, you know, if he's loosening too much, that inflation could, the inflation could, that fire could rage out of control. It's very difficult to get that back in line, as we've seen. I mean, it's just the law of physics. It's very much like a wildfire. But if they print too much money, which they did, and we saw happen, and then they scrambled and in a near panic to get the that under control by not only you know, implementing QT, quantitative tightening, where they're selling those bonds that they bought off their books, the Fed, but also by raising interest rates at a breakneck speed, which they did. And but inflation got above 9% that we admitted to. I mean, you can't tell me that my insurance costs were up only 20%. I mean, they've doubled. And I'm, you know, knock on wood, great driver, with basically a perfect record here. And my insurance just keeps going up and up and up and up and up. There are a lot of reasons for that. You know, the simple reason is inflation. Another reason is because you have a lot of uninsured drivers out there that, you know, the insurance companies have to raise the prices in order to cover the costs of everybody else who's not paying for it, just like healthcare. Just like Obamacare created the same situation. The people who are paying for health insurance are paying more to subsidize the ones who are not paying for it. And it's just
this bull run, I think everybody should focus on getting their Bitcoin in self-custody and off exchanges. We all saw what happened last time with the huge blow-offs. We had Celsius, FTX, all of the big dogs blowing up. Well, this time everybody's being smart and holding their Bitcoin in self-custody. This is why I'm going with the number one hardware wallet in the game. That's Trezor. You can go to trezor.io or the affiliate link below to get yours for 5% off using promo code GreenCandle. Get your Bitcoin off exchanges in the easiest way possible. They are a trusted brand. They've been in the game the longest of any hardware wallets out there. So that's why I've partnered with them, making it the easiest for you to get your Bitcoin off exchanges and not have to worry about any counterparty risk. So do it today. Go to the affiliate link below. Use promo code GreenCandle. Enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
The reality, or are getting subsidized to get coverage. It's just the reality of the structured program. That's the way it is. So, but you know, back to your point, it's lagging. It's always lagging. It's imperfect. It's always imperfect. These surveys are almost, they're almost comical. You know, you've got half the people don't even answer the surveys, and then, you know, the ones that do are giving them data that may or may not be accurate, and it's lagging terribly. And then they go back and revise it. The one thing it doesn't get revised is the unemployment number. So even though you've got 500,000 jobs have been taken off the table from beginning of the year, the unemployment number doesn't get revised, just the number of jobs that they counted. And one of the big things that I always wonder about is there's a huge assumption in these numbers that's called the birth and death model. And that's the birth and death of companies. And so they assume that there are companies being created and companies that are being destroyed, shut down along the way. And those assumptions have massive numbers of jobs around them. And if that assumption's wrong, then it can sway, you know, by 50, 100,000 jobs either way, easily. And so that's a big problem, and they've got to figure that out. And then again, the Fed is lagging. And to go back to the analogy of the wildfire, if they get it wrong on one side where they are too easy, they make the policy is too easy, it's expansionary, they print money, they give it out, they have low interest rates, they have ZERP, zero interest rate policy. it makes everything, you know, more expensive, and there's more dollars out there. There's more borrowing. There's more dollars created through borrowing, through the way the banking system works. And it's created from the Fed and put out to the consumers. Hard to get that inflation rage under control, that fire. On the flip side, Powell would rather be overly tight. Why? Because it's easier to jumpstart the economy by implementing QE, by printing money and buying bonds and putting money out there that wasn't out there before, and controlling that flow and lowering interest rates to get the economy going. It's easier for him to do that than the flip side. And so he'd rather get in the situation where the Fed has to control the just the steepness and the depth of that drawdown and recession by printing money and easing interest rates. So, and he's doing it in a way that's lagging the economy. And so that's what gives investors pause. And that's what worries them, is that he's going to stay too tight for too long. And here we go again. The Fed's going to create another recession by, you know, keeping a lid on the money supply and on liquidity.
Now, everybody thinks that once these interest rates cut, everything in the market is going to be fine and dandy, and then we're going to take off. Do you see it as that way as well? Or is it, because I mean, I feel like when we have such a strong, I guess we'll call it groupthink, like everybody's agreeing on one thing. Once we cut interest rates, Bitcoin's going to take off. Everything in the market always does the opposite, at least maybe initially. So, you know, do you see it as that way as well? Like, it's so clear cut that once the Fed, you know, cuts interest rates, everything will be, I guess, a little bit smoother, or is there going to be some bumps along the road?
Yeah, I think you're describing the market is forward looking and it's already priced in. And that's typically the case. So if you've got everybody as bullish, well, then you better get out because there's nobody left to buy. And so I don't believe that's the case because of the situation we're in here, Brandon, where it's late summer. It's pretty quiet. We've had this run of treasury companies that have been created. We can talk about that. There's confusion around some of their strategies, like MicroStrategy. You know, that's been in the market today. There's fear out there that Bitcoin has touched all-time high. It backed off, and I'm kind of looking at the chart over here as I'm looking at it. To me, it's great. I mean, it gives an opportunity for us to go in and opportunistically buy some while everybody else is asleep, and that's fine. If the Fed cuts rates, it's priced into the market. The market will just kind of grind sideways here for a little bit, I think. If he comes out and he's extremely dovish, then the market would rip. If he sounds too dovish, though, that he sounds like he's really worried that he's seeing some things that means that we're already in a recession, that would give me some discomfort, and that would give investors discomfort that they would say, oh no, he thinks we're going to hit the skids here. We're going to be, you know, in a recession that's bad. So we're in this funny period. It's kind of perverse, Brandon, that bad news is good news for the market and good news is bad news for the market, in that if the employment rate goes down, jobs numbers are good. That's not good because the market wants more liquidity and they want the Fed to ease and vice versa. So I think 25 basis points is priced in. I think, you know, two cuts are priced into the market for the rest of the year, one here in September, and then another one in October, so, or December, somewhere in there. But there's two cuts basically have been priced in, maybe a little bit more, but that's it. If we get three cuts, the market will rip. If we get one cut, the market will sell off. They'll reprice it. Everything will get repriced off of that. But right now, that's what the market is telling you.
And that's interesting. So, you know, then that gets to the all-time highs that we've kind of hitting in and floating around, I guess, because you've mentioned this a little bit earlier in our conversation, how Bitcoin is showing, I guess, a little bit of the tendency here, right? Where, you know, it's the leading tech indicator. And, you know, whether the maxis want to agree with it or not, that's essentially what the market is showing. But I mean, the reality is like, we've gone down maybe like 4, 5, 6% from the all-time high. And in Bitcoin terms, that's not really that much. You know, so we're still kind of floating around that all-time high. But it seems like, you know, with the amount of buying that's coming on with these treasury companies, the price just isn't ripping. So is it, even though these treasury companies are coming on, is it just not the volume needed just yet? Or is there still some whales or potentially other reasons, other factors that are going in that are causing like the price not to start to rip just yet?
Well, I mean, we've seen whales selling. We saw a big whale sell 80,000 Bitcoin just a couple of weeks ago. Price barely moved. You know, that's good news. Now the question is, are they selling to go fund a lifestyle that they've held out for? Which, hey, God bless. You know, if you have held on to 1,000 Bitcoin for this long and you want to go monetize that, 80,000 Bitcoin for this long and you want to go monetize that, it's billions of dollars, you know? Yeah, I mean, okay. How can you fault that? Go buy your chateau or your yacht or whatever that you're looking for and fund that lifestyle that you want, that you've held out for. Great, whatever. No big deal. But I think that some of these whales that are selling are turning around and saying, they're like, look, I've had 100, 200 or whatever X on my money already. I want to get to, like right now, yeah, we may get a 10X in Bitcoin. I believe we get a 10X in Bitcoin over the next 7, 8 years. That's nothing like I've experienced up to now. The OGs, the whales that have been around for a long time. And so I think some of them want to remain in Bitcoin, but they want to get a little bit more out of it in this space. And there's a way to do that. The way to do that is to buy these Bitcoin treasury companies, because they'll give you what will be a multiple on that return, I believe. Now, not all of them, some of them. A handful of them will do very well, I think. That's my thesis. It's the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, you know, that my hedge fund, that's what we believe. And we're invested in some of these because we believe that. Not all of them. We're not invested in every single treasury company, but we're invested in a select number of them that we believe in. So I think that there's some rotation going there, Brandon, that's coming out of Bitcoin, going into these treasury companies, and it's being washed back into Bitcoin as it happens. That's why you're seeing the price kind of grind sideways, higher, a little bit lower, sideways. You know, it's kind of grinding here from 100 to 120. You know, it's been in this range since May, basically. You know, it dipped down a little bit in June, but since May, it's been in that range. It was in the 100 to 110 level, and then it moved up in July from 110 to 120. It's been between there and 110, 111, somewhere in there since the beginning of July. And I think what you're seeing is this rotation out, some OGs that are moving out of Bitcoin and into the treasury companies. And some of them are joining boards and doing that stuff and creating these treasury companies themselves. I mean, Adam Back is doing one. I don't, you know, good for him. You know, he's looking for new things to do. The guy has been doing this since the days of the message board with Satoshi. I mean, he's looking for creative ways to not just expand his wealth, but to expand the reach of Bitcoin in the community. And I've had long conversations with him. And so I think that some people didn't know whether he's selling any Bitcoin to do it himself. I don't know. You know, I haven't spoken with him specifically about that, but I would think there are some who are doing that, and I don't blame them, and, you know, have at it. It's that's why we call it the Bitcoin's the best free market. Do what you want to do with it. we want to hold it. That's what I'm doing. But, you know, there are other things to do. And that's why we started that fund. And and we're enjoying all this. There's a massive amount of opportunity out there from our position.
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely think that there is. And then, you know, we've kind of seen this, you know, we touched on it briefly, the uncorrelation, so to speak, of these Bitcoin treasury companies from Bitcoin, or at least, you know, we had Bitcoin hit a massive all-time high. And I think, you know, I saw an account that tweeted out MicroStrategy was down 29%. You know, we saw some of these treasury companies be down as much as like 75-80%, you know, when Bitcoin was hitting those all-time highs. So I guess the initial narrative was always that these treasury companies, or at least MicroStrategy, MSTR, StrategyB, whatever you want to call it now, is like a 2 to 5 to 8, you know, X levered play on Bitcoin. Why would you ever hold generational wealth on a piece of paper? It doesn't make sense. You need a foolproof solution, and I've got it for you. You could get this as low as $25, and if you use promo code GreenCandle, you could get 10% off. Being around for 12 years, they've engineered the perfect and most easy to use solution. I've partnered with CryptoSteel to offer for you guys just that. It is the cheapest and most secure way to store your seed phrase. I don't know about you guys, but I don't have too many things where I think one ton is going to fall on this, but it could survive all of that and more. So go to CryptoSteel.com. You can use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order if you go there today. So go ahead and protect your generational wealth and do it with CryptoSteel. All right, enough from me. Back to the show. Now, it seems like that narrative has been shifting a little bit as of late, where people are more tentative on that and saying, you know, some of these treasury companies are not going to make it. Now, how do you view and I guess evaluate some of these? Are you looking at them more as like you like the ones that actually have an underlying business outside of the holding strategy? Or do you like maybe the CEO's ability to raise money? How are you kind of looking at these? And why do you think that there is, seemingly a disconnect, at least in the market in the short term right now, from these treasury companies to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So first of all, the MNAV that you're talking about, the multiple on the underlying Bitcoin on their balance sheet, that's MNAV, multiple on the NAV of the Bitcoin on the balance sheet. You know, we've seen these things fluctuate around. We started buying MicroStrategy when the MNAV was 1.2. But we talked to them. We talked to Michael and we talked to Shirish, their treasurer, who helped implement this strategy, was spearheading it for them. We understood what they were trying to do and what their goal was and what their goal is. And so, we still believe that. He's created all kinds of strategies around it. So MicroStrategy is a kind of a special situation because they're so far ahead of everybody else. They've got over 600,000 Bitcoin now. And so, they've got access to capital markets that other companies just don't have. Not all of them, some of them do. You know, CEP 21 certainly does with the involvement of Cantor and Jack Mahler's new play there. But there's all kinds of different ways that these companies can create the ability to buy more Bitcoin. And it's using converts, which can actively dampen the volatility. Well, it actually dampens, it holds the price of the stock down, because as you issue a convert, there are convert arbitrage traders that will buy the convert and then short the stock in order to delta hedge it. And like what's called the optimal hedge around owning that convertible bond, because it can be converted into stock at a certain price. So they'll trade around that. Or you could do preferred shares like MicroStrategy is doing, and that is not dilutive to the stock. It doesn't put pressure on the stock, because you're basically saying that we're going to pay you a dividend off of the future, basically the future price of Bitcoin. And so that's a special case. But there are other cases. Like Metaplanet came out and was basically the only proxy for Bitcoin in all of Japan. So if you were a retirement account or an investor that wanted to buy Bitcoin but couldn't get it into your brokerage, you could buy Metaplanet and get a proxy to that. And now they're doing a similar playbook to MicroStrategy. And so they're able to create a way to arbitrage the capital markets. You're borrowing money in yen and you're buying Bitcoin with it. It's an arbitrage. And so they will warrant a different multiple. They have a different kind of moat there because there's not another proxy for buying Bitcoin there like that. So that's a strong moat. It could change. We don't know if and when, but that's more of a regulatory issue. Then you've got the same thing in other areas, you know, whether it's Brazil or Canada or the UK, you've got similar situations. And so there are companies that were invested in those areas because of that. Then you get the question of what you're saying is, what MNAV makes sense? And it is different for each one. And it really depends on a lot of the factors that you named. Do they have a moat? Is it a geographical regulatory moat? Is it that they have great access to capital to expand their balance sheet? Do they have an original investor in and partner in their venture, like CEP does with Tether, 21 does with Tether? Is there something like that going on? Who is the CEO? Can they generate enough interest and can they lead that strategy to that Bitcoin treasury strategy to do that? That's another question mark. And we believe that these things are going to settle in somewhere around 1 to 2.5 MNAV for virtually all of them. There may be outliers like Metaplanet that will be higher. But what we're seeing here, in my opinion, Brandon, is people figuring that out and trying to shake out who should be trading at what MNAV according to what they believe they can, how much Bitcoin yield they can generate, meaning how much of an MNAV should they trade at because of how much more Bitcoin they can create in their balance sheet per shareholder. And so, but we're watching that closely and it's going to play out here. Now, as far as our fund is concerned, we're now out there buying things that are trading at 8, 9, 10 MNAV. Like that doesn't make any sense for us being a hedge fund. And we can, we're structured in a way that we can invest in these before they come to market. So they're private deals, they're pipes, they're, you know, private investments before they hit the market. They're pre-IPO, pre-merger of SPACs. And so we're getting these things much closer to one MNAV, in some cases less than one, which is basically you're buying Bitcoin for less than the price it's trading here. And so, and you're taking the risk of that company executing their plan to do that. But we're fortunate that we're able to get these some of these companies in the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund because we're a hedge fund. We're not a venture fund. You know, we're structured as a straight hedge fund. And we're doing things like this because we can. We can buy these things for one or less than one MNAV or just above one MNAV. And, you know, they're trading at much, much, much higher multiples on paper right now. That's the advantage of being structured the way we are, that we can do anything, public, private, early stage, late stage, it doesn't matter. As long as it's Bitcoin related, we have the structure that we can be involved. And so we're kind of fortunate that way. And that's a little bit of our edge. Cautiously we're still approaching that, and we see a lot of opportunity in this still. A whole lot of opportunity in this space still and a lot of runway there. But again, we're not just out there buying these things at public MNAV prices, you know, by rote. We're very careful and strategic in the way that we're doing it.
Now, you said something interesting here where I've heard you and Michael Saylor, for some reason, always point out Metaplanet, right? I mean, it seems like, you know, in reality, they're like the seventh or, you know, eighth biggest holder. But everybody always talks about Metaplanet. Is it something unique with Japan's market? And if so, you know, why do you think that Michael Saylor has mentioned that, oh, you know, of all companies, the only player that could potentially catch us would be Metaplanet, and seemingly that he's hinting that's because of Japan, but I'd like to hear, you know, kind of your viewpoint on it.
Yeah, I mean, look, he knows Dylan LeClaire. Dylan, actually, I was there. I was standing with Dylan when he was telling me about being approached by Metaplanet and thinking about doing this. And he actually went up to Michael Saylor and said, "This is what I'm thinking about doing," and Michael literally told him, "Go for it," you know, right there in at this conference. And so, and it is structural, it is regional, it is regulatory that they have this advantage there. But they also have they've got good management to execute on that plan. Will they catch MicroStrategy? I don't believe that. I don't believe they will. I mean, MicroStrategy is just so far ahead that I don't see anybody catching them, truly. But I do see a handful of players that will be in that top tier. And Metaplanet is one of them, you know. But there are other ones, you know. There are other ones that are out there, including ones that I probably shouldn't talk about because they're not public yet. So but we do believe that it's not just management. It's not just structure. It's like the whole package. You've got to be able to execute on this in a way that continues to give your shareholders trust that you're going to execute the plan you say you're going to execute, because they're giving you a premium to your price on the expectation and the agreement that you're going to do the plan that you say you're going to do.
Yeah. So then, all right. So if it's no other public company, you know, what do you think of, I guess, the differences between like a Metaplanet and say a 21, which seemingly, you know, their strategy at 21 is just like a Bitcoin holding company, where Metaplanet, although it was failing, they had, you know, the hotel businesses underneath. MicroStrategy had the, you know, the SaaS business underneath. Do you think that there's a major difference in this? Like, you know, Semler Scientific, for example, has the you know, healthcare type of angle to it. Is there different valuations you think for companies that have this underlying business and are putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet opposed to just these strict Bitcoin treasury companies, it seems?
Yeah. There's going to be, you know, a maturity process here in all of these companies, and in the companies who do add Bitcoin to their balance sheet. So you hit on something that's important. Let's kind of unpack this. 21. Okay. So MicroStrategy is they basically said they're executing a financial engineering strategy to get more Bitcoin on the balance sheet for their shareholders. That's all they've said so far. I do believe that they're going to get big enough that they can do other things with that Bitcoin. They have not laid out a plan for that yet. Michael's a smart guy. He's going to figure out ways that they can capitalize that and keep growing this company. He wants, you know, to eventually be the biggest company in the world. Why not? And he eventually will be if he sticks with the strategy and Bitcoin does what we think it's going to do. 21 explicitly came out and said they're going to be a Bitcoin finance company. They're going to structure products around it, lending products, collateralized products, you know? So that is different. That is what they're headed to do. That's their goal. It's a different strategy. Metaplanet is much more along the lines of a Japanese version of strategy, of MicroStrategy, doing the same kind of financial engineering. And then you've got other companies that are looking to use cash flows to fund this Bitcoin treasury. This is really important. And this is something that we have not seen be rewarded yet, which is real companies with real cash flows using those cash flows to buy Bitcoin and add to their treasury. That has not been rewarded yet. The current reward is financially engineer Wall Street out of dollars to use those dollars to put into Bitcoin. And so arbitrage that capital market. That's been the big play so far. I do believe that eventually we get to this point, Brandon, where people realize that the best play long-term, once this has been kind of soaked up, the capital markets play, the arbitrage play, it's going to be using cash flows to buy Bitcoin and put it on your treasury. Ultimately, the ultimate goal, you know, sign of maturity of this space is when you have companies that are S&P 500 companies that are not just the Apples and Microsofts and Googles of the world, but eventually they are doing this, where they are cash cows. You're creating billions of dollars and billions of dollars, and they're turning around and buying billions of dollars of Bitcoin with that. I believe that's a future, but that's a way off. In that time between now and then, you're going to see smaller companies. You're going to see, you know, whether they're REITs or they're other types of cash generating companies, smaller companies that are more, they're using their cash flows to buy the Bitcoin, much like you would see something like the playbook of a Warren Buffett, where he used cash flows to buy companies. Well, use cash flows to buy Bitcoin, you know. So it's that kind of model eventually to grow your Bitcoin treasury. And to then the ultimate end game is to protect your hard-earned money by putting it in Bitcoin and protect your treasury, not by buying bonds, but by buying Bitcoin, because bonds will be melted away with extreme inflation and can be rapidly. So you have to be careful of those. So long-term bonds, like long-duration bonds. So I think that's how we mature in this industry. So that's why we believe that there's a long, long, long runway here for Bitcoin and the expansion of understanding it. And that's really where this comes out, where a broad set of investors and executives understand Bitcoin enough to know that it's the ultimate store of value, and they should be putting part of their treasury, if not all of it, in Bitcoin eventually. That's a ways off again, but I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah, but something that worries me with all of this, right, is like you know you're describing the financial engineering, and I like kind of the way you put that, where these companies are utilizing Wall Street and, you know, the traditional financial products to essentially put more Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and utilizing basically like a group of people and making it a business and getting a big loan so they could buy more Bitcoin quicker than, you know, the average Joe really could. Now, you know, with that, it seems like all this debt, it's just kind of stacking up on these, you know, utilizing the debt markets, the traditional financial tools to buy more Bitcoin, is almost like on a house of cards, where if we do have this big downturn, that this could be kind of like the spark of, you know, maybe not to the extent of an FTX, but maybe, you know, maybe we have enough of these companies coming in and just being kind of irresponsible with the amount of debt that is just going to be accumulated to buy Bitcoin. Now, yeah. Is that a possibility in your mind, or is there just not enough money being lent out for this to be, you know, I mean, although we see the billions, it's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, is it enough to kind of cause this, I guess, quote unquote, black swan type of event?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question, and it's a lot of fear out there about this, but the reality is, like, MicroStrategy is only, you know, 20% levered. So you could have an 80% drawdown in Bitcoin just on that math alone. But the reality is that his interest payments on his preferreds, his, you know, the maturity of those converts, the converts are not even, he doesn't have to pay interest on those. There's 0% converts. So, but he doesn't have to retire those, or pay for them all at once. It's a ladder, you know, a time ladder. So that doesn't worry me at all. People talk about strategy being, oh, so leveraged, like it would be, even if it did get to a point where he needed to pay down some of the debt because it's retiring, it's maturing and the capital markets are closed, he could sell some Bitcoin to do that. And it wouldn't be that big of a deal compared to how much Bitcoin he owns. And this time ladder, the way that they strategically, you know, that's why they call it their company strategy now. They strategically created a situation where they wouldn't be overrun with a tsunami of capital needs. So that's intelligent financial engineering. We are seeing some that are a little bit more out there on the risk curve that we have not gotten comfort with. So we don't do those. They're not huge. They're small. And some of them will blow up because they get over their ski tips and they need liquidity. They can't have access to the capital markets for, they have to sell their Bitcoin. And then it kind of feeds on itself where their MNAV goes down and then they have to sell, they wind up selling more than they wanted to. They don't have access to capital markets. That could happen to some of these. And I expect it to happen to a handful of them, but I don't think it's a situation like you're describing, because the truth is, the reality is that, you know, they aren't stacking debt on debt on debt to do this. The biggest ones, they're just not, levered the way that people are feared, or that it may be painted in the press. It's not true. So I'm not particularly worried about that, at least the way the market is structured today and the way we're seeing these companies buy Bitcoin and financially engineer it today. Could it get worse in the future? Sure. But I think today we're okay.
Yeah, it's just a bunch of FUD, right, James? I mean, it's like every single Bitcoin bull run, we always get some new FUD. So, I mean, I guess this is the newest FUD that we're having here. So, we were talking a little bit about it previously, but the Fed cutting interest rates and kind of seeing it, you know, Q3, Q4 is generally when Bitcoin really starts to take off here. You know, I mean, November, you know, we got Moontober, all those kind of memes that they're already throwing around. And it seems like that's
going to be a reason for it. But yeah, there's a reason for it. We'll get into it, but go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, then let's get into it, because it seems like that's going to be lining up with the Fed cutting interest rates.
It all lines up.
Are we going to be taking off towards the end of the year? Like, how do you see the rest of this playing out? And, you know, on top of that, everybody always says the 4-year cycles. It seems like because of this bigger money in here, I'm curious what you think of as this, you know, quote unquote asset is developing, you know, bigger market cap and everything. Do you see the volatility going down in the 4-year cycles period kind of ending, or do you see it kind of the other way?
Well, we've hit our all-time high, just a few days ago. And so now you're getting into the end of August, you got this, the Jackson Hole, and then you've got the Fed meeting in September. On top of that, Brandon, you have what's called, it's the fourth quarter dress up. It's like these window dressing of fund managers, investment managers, CIOs. They've got to get themselves positioned, their portfolio positioned for payout at the end of the year. They get paid bonuses.
This bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer. all the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
And so part of their review is how did their portfolio do? What names do they have in it? How did those do? And what are the prospects going forward for the portfolio? And what are they seeing? How are they positioned? And so, you know, did you cut your losers? Are you adding to your winners? Like, how are you doing here? And so you get a lot of that in September, a little bit in October, but a lot of it is in September because, you know, that they want to be positioned for that fourth quarter, that last quarter. And so September, October, you get a lot of movement in these big names because the fund managers, not just the hedge fund managers, but the massive investment managers like the, you know, the Guggenheims and the Pimcos and the CalPERS and the Texas Teachers of the world, they're moving the stuff around. And so you're going to have some of that. So what do I think is going to happen? We're going to get that Fed meeting. We're going to get the September. I think we're going to probably get a 25 basis point cut, all things being equal. If the data comes in benign between now and then, anything can change. The data could change in a heartbeat, as we've seen, especially with the tariff stuff. But all things being equal, as of today, I see a 25 basis point cut. And I see the market kind of, you know, either shrugging or selling off on that. And that being an opportunity, because you're right. The once we go back and expand this liquidity, and Bitcoin lags that expansion by 8 to 12 weeks, and that expansion continues, well, Bitcoin's going to continue to expand as well. And I expect it to be in the, you know, $150,000 to $180,000 range toward year end. I think I just saw the Mooch. He said 180 to 200 on CNBC or something. And so I'm kind of in the same camp with him. It all has to do with liquidity, the expansion of the money supply and expansion of liquidity, not just M2, but credit. And Michael Howell does a lot of great work on this. I've talked with him at great length about this. Actually, there's a video all about it on my Substack that I talked to him about it. And we talk through how he looks at this and how what he expects. His view is, you know, it's matured since then, or it's you know, moved a little bit. But and you can see it on his newsletter. But you know, long and short of it is, I believe that liquidity expands through the end of the year and into next year, and Bitcoin lags that, which means that Bitcoin's going to continue. It's going to go break this last all-time high, and it's going to go to 150, 180, or maybe even higher before the end of the year, and could hit in the low twos into next year before we see a kind of drying up of liquidity. And that's what, so we're watching for that. I don't know if it happens, but we're watching for it. Those are the signals we're looking for. And that's kind of where I hate price predictions, but if I'm looking at liquidity and I'm looking at the markets, I'm looking at what to expect, that's kind of where my mind is today.
Gotcha. And yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? Everything can seemingly change. And it seems like a lot has changed kind of in the adoption cycle, so to speak. So I know you work a little bit with Mark Moss and the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. He, when I had him on, lined out something very, you know, distinctly to me. And it's kind of stuck with me about the 50-year period or cycles of how Bitcoin could potentially develop, because it's happened in history. The first 10 years is retail, second 10 years is institution, third 10 years is governments. Then we get to maybe a medium of exchange in that fourth year. And then in the fifth year, that's when we'll get to that unit of account. Do you see it kind of playing out that way as well? And if that is the case, then do you see us kind of, I guess, almost delaying the governmental adoption here? Because, you know, it seems like at first when Trump got into office, it was very gung-ho and we're going to be, you know, the crypto leader in the of the world and, you know, Bitcoin strategic reserve. And then, you know, it always seems like they're kind of backtracking every time I hear them in the news following that. So how do you see kind of the development of just, you know, Bitcoin taking it over? Because it seems like we're in the Bitcoinization of finance right now.
Yeah, I think that Mark's a smart guy and that makes perfect sense. And what makes most sense to me is that this is a long timeline. I don't think that we have hyper Bitcoinization in the next 10 years. I just don't think that. I think people, you know, why we exchange dollars is not because it's backed by anything. It's just, it's only backed by the belief that if I take a dollar from you, I can go use it somewhere else and someone else is going to take it too. That's it. Simple as that. And so it's just confidence in it. And the confidence in the US dollar is by far greater than any other currency in the entire world. There's nothing that has more confidence in it. I mean, even if you take gold, like I can't just go spend gold somewhere. Someone's got to figure out how much it's worth and their dollars or their, you know, yen or their yuan, like what is it worth? And it's just clunky, you know? So eventually gold has been the ultimate store of value, meaning that it for thousands of years, it's held its value. You can get about the same amount of goods, the same 400 loaves of bread or same tailored suit or whatever with 1 ounce of gold. And so that's been a good store of value. Bitcoin's going to continue to take that helm. It's going to continue to win over that helm. And as it does that, I think it winds up strengthening the dollar if the U.S. backs it, if the U.S. Adopts it and puts it in a strategic reserve. It winds up strengthening the U.S. balance sheet and the confidence in the U.S. dollar for a while. So whether or not they ever turn around and back bonds with Bitcoin remains to be seen. I think that eventually they're going to be backed into a corner where they're going to have little choice but to do so in order to keep spending. So that's a long way off though, Brandon. I think it does move in 50-year cycles at best. And so it's going to take a long time. I think that when I'm gone and my kids are, you know, my age, it's going to be a completely different world for money. And it's hard for people to wrap their heads around that because everybody alive now knows the US dollar is being the king, but that has not always been the case and it won't always be the case. You know, we will eventually migrate to a different system monetarily. And at this point, I would bet on Bitcoin. We'll see. Or maybe I won't see, but you might.
James, I mean, you're talking so grim here, man, about maybe you won't see with everything. I mean, I think the only thing you won't see in the future, maybe for the rest of your life, is Texas winning another national. we can put it on that there. So we all know the Aggies will win it. So you don't have to worry about that. So maybe we'll get to the hyper Bitcoinization a little bit sooner than that, though. But, you know, with that, I want to have some fun with you now. Now that I got my little chop in, yeah. What do you see from your Longhorns this year, James? I know last time we had you on, we talked a little hockey. Now I want to hear your prediction. I mean, you guys are coming in. Texas is back as always, you know, number one preseason team. And we're coming in right before the college football season's going. So is Texas going to win the national championship? I know you said you don't like price predictions, but I'll have to put you on a spot for a college football prediction.
Man, it's hard coming into the season as number one, isn't it? You've got the bullseye on your chest all year, if they can hold it. First, I got to come out and play number three, Ohio State. That's just nuts. You know, that's going to be a fun game. So what do the Longhorns have? Well, they've got a really strong D, which is, that's exciting, you know, to be able to hold other teams down. I just remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, when Oklahoma would come in to the Cotton Bowl and you'd be all revved up because we had this great offense. And then next thing you know, you're getting absolutely obliterated because Oklahoma put 65 points on the board, you know? So that's actually pretty exciting. Everybody's talking about Arch Manning. And so another one that's got a bullseye on his chest, the guy's played just a handful of games and not a full game, right? So he's only been in certain situations. He's done extremely well. He's got the poise of a Manning, and he's shown that he's got that size. He's getting bigger, he's getting stronger, he's getting smarter. But this is going to be a big test for him, because he's coming out as a leading candidate for the Heisman Trophy, and he's only played partially in a few games. So that's kind of crazy to me. It's a lot of pressure for a kid. And he is a kid. He's 20 something years old. I mean, like, he's just a kid. But I think he's ready to step up, and it's going to be very interesting to see. The first game's going to be a huge test. It can set the tone for the whole year, but I have high hopes for him. Do I think they ultimately win it? It's hard to say, you know, but I do think that they ultimately will be in the playoffs. So, I don't know if I'd say the same about the Aggies this year.
Everybody's always a hater on the Aggies, man. I think we're a little bit of a dark horse this year. We got a good defense. That's what A&M always has. We always got a good defensive line. We'll always have some good corners. I mean, you can see the guys in the pros, Von Miller, Miles Garrett, all those guys.
They can frustrate teams. If they put their minds to it, they can really. And I've been to Kyle Field. That wall of Aggies, you know, the 11th man. I mean, that is
12th man, dude. It's a 12th man.
That is impressive. You know, that is impressive. And it's, I mean, that is, you walk in there, that's a lot of noise. And so Kyle Field's, to me, it'd be a tough place to play. I don't know. It's going to be exciting and interesting. It's really fun season to me. It's going to be real fun. So,
And I got
another daughter over. She's a Gator. So that's another.
Oh,
one. We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah. So those two are, they're little intra family rivalry. So.
Hey, Lagway is going to be nice this year. I mean, I'm out here in Tampa, so like half the people are Florida State fans, half the people are Gators. So, I mean, I hear it from both ends as well out here. But James, I feel like we got to do a little bit of a bet here for the Thanksgiving game here. I will ride with my Aggies here. And if not, I don't know. I mean, maybe we got to put like 10K sats or 20K sats or something like that on it.
You name the sats, and that's the bet.
All right, we'll do 21K sats on. I'll take the Aggies. You could take the Longhorns straight up. I mean, I'm sure the Longhorns will be heavily favored, so I'm gonna be looking a little grim going into it. But I'll put it on the line for my Aggies here this time.
All right, it's a bet.
All right. Sounds good. Well, James, thanks so much for playing along with me here at the end and the insightful conversation that you always bring. Why don't you tell people more about where they can find you and what you guys got going on in the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund?
Yeah, of course. My newsletter is it's The Informationist, and you can find it at jameslavish.com. And I put it out each week and just simplify one, confusing financial topic for you weekly. There's a free version that comes out once a month. And then the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. Yeah, we just started raising Fund 2. We've already raised over 20% of our goal, and we're super excited. It's a public private partnership that invests in the Bitcoin space. Like you heard, all these things that we're doing, it's for accredited investors. I have to say that. But if you're interested, you can just get more info at www.bitcoinopportunity.fund. And just put in your information, and we can set up a call or whatever and see if it's appropriate for you. We're always looking for good new LPs. So, but we're super excited. It's a great space to be in, really good time to be in it. And there's a long road ahead, a lot of runway ahead of us. So.
100%. Yeah, this bull run is just getting started. So there's a lot of great things ahead, and I'll put all that in the show notes. And James, thanks so much.
Awesome to be here, Brandon. Look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them, and I'll see you guys all at the next one.